Blackstone Audio presents Autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1. Introduction. Between 1870 and 1905, Mark Twain, Samuel L. Clemens, tried repeatedly and at long intervals to write or dictate his autobiography, always shelving the manuscript before he had made much progress. By 1905, he had accumulated some 30 or 40 of these false starts, manuscripts that were essentially experiments, drafts of episodes and chapters. Many of these have survived in the Mark Twain papers and two other libraries. To some of these manuscripts, he went so far as to assign chapter numbers that placed them early or late in a narrative which he never filled in, let alone completed. None dealt with more than brief snatches of his life story. He broke this pattern in January 1906 when he began almost daily dictations to a stenographer. He soon decided that these autobiographical dictations would form the bulk of what he would call the autobiography of Mark Twain. Within a few months, he reviewed his accumulation of false starts and decided which to incorporate into the newer dictation series and which to leave unpublished. By the time he had created more than 250 of these almost daily dictations and written a final chapter in December 1909 about the recent death of his daughter Jean, he had compiled more than 500,000 words. He declared the work done, but insisted that it should not be published in its entirety until 100 years after his death, which occurred less than 4 months later, on the 21st of April, 1910. This belated success with a project that had resisted completion for 35 years can be traced to two new conditions. First, he had at last found a skilled stenographer who was also a responsive audience, Josephine S. Hobby, which encouraged him to embrace dictation as the method of composition, something he had experimented with as early as 1885. Second, and just as important, dictating the text made it easier to follow a style of composition he had been drifting toward for at least 20 years. As he put it in June 1906, he had finally seen that the right way to do an autobiography was to start it at no particular time of your life, wander at your free will all over your life, talk only about the thing which interests you for the moment, drop it the moment its interest threatens to pale, and turn your talk upon the new and more interesting thing that has intruded itself into your mind meantime. Combining dictation and discursiveness in this bold way was unexpectedly liberating, in large part because it produced not a conventional narrative marching inexorably toward the grave, but rather a series of spontaneous recollections and comments on the present as well as the past, arranged simply in the order of their creation. The problem of method had been solved. It was also liberating to insist on posthumous publication, but that idea had been around from the start and was closely tied to Clemens's ambition to tell the whole truth without reservation. As he explained to an interviewer in 1899, "A book that is not to be published for a century gives the writer a freedom which he could secure in no other way. In these conditions you can draw a man without prejudice exactly as you knew him, and yet have no fear of hurting his feelings or those of his sons or grandsons." Posthumous publication was also supposed to make it easier for Clemens to confess even shameful parts of his own story, but that goal proved illusory. In that same 1899 interview, he admitted that "a man cannot tell the whole truth about himself, even if convinced that what he wrote would never be seen by others." But if delaying publication failed to make him into a confessional autobiographer, it did free him to express unconventional thoughts about religion, politics, and the damned human race, without fear of ostracism. In January 1908, he recalled that he had long had "the common habit in private conversation with friends of revealing every private opinion I possessed relating to religion, politics, and men," adding that he would never dream of printing one of them. The need to defer publication of subversive ideas seemed obvious to him. "We suppress an unpopular opinion because we cannot afford the bitter cost of putting it forth," he wrote in 1905. "None of us likes to be hated. None of us likes to be shunned. So, having the freedom to speak his mind, if not confess his sins, was still ample justification for delaying publication until after his death." 7 months after he began the autobiographical dictations in 1906, however, Clemens did permit, indeed actively pursued, partial publication of what he had so far accumulated. he supervised the preparation of some 25 short extracts from his autobiographical manuscripts and dictations for publication in the North American Review, each selection deliberately tamed for that time and audience, and each prefaced by a notice. No part of the autobiography will be published in book form during the lifetime of the author. But not long after Clemens died, his instruction to delay publication for 100 years began to be ignored. First in 1924 by Albert Bigelow Payne, Mark Twain's official biographer and first literary executor, then in 1940 by Payne's successor, Bernard DeVoto, and most recently by Charles Nider in 1959. Each of these editors undertook to publish only a part of the text, and none ventured to do so in the way that Clemens actually wanted it published. Payne began his two-volume edition with all but a handful of the manuscripts and dictations carried out before 1906, as well as several texts that were probably never part of those early experiments. He arranged all of them in accordance with the author's wish, in the order in which they were written, regardless of the chronology of events. It now seems clear that Payne's understanding of the author's wish was mistaken. Clemens never intended to include all those false starts, let alone in chronological order. He intended only the dictations begun in 1906 to be published that way. But having chosen this course, Payne then had space for only a relative handful of the dictations, and on top of that, he felt obliged to suppress or even alter certain passages without notice to the reader. He eventually acknowledged that he had published only about one-third of what he regarded as the whole text. DeVoto was critical of Payne's acceptance of the arrangement Mark Twain originally gave the dictations, interspersed as they were with trivialities, irrelevancies, newspaper clippings, and unimportant letters, disconnected and without plan. Instead, he chose to print only passages that Payne had left unpublished, drawn from the typescript in which everything that Mark wanted in his memoirs had been brought together, that is, the autobiographical dictations begun in 1906. DeVoto then arranged the selections by topic, omitting trivialities and joining together things that belonged together, and he said with great satisfaction that he had modernized the punctuation by deleting thousands of commas and dashes, and probably should have deleted hundreds more. He was confident that he had given the book a more coherent plan than Mark Twain's, and he was unapologetic about having left out what seemed to him uninteresting. Nider, too, was unhappy with Payne's acceptance of Mark Twain's plan to publish the autobiography not in chronological order, but in the sequence in which it was written and dictated. What an extraordinary idea! As though the stream of composition time were in some mysterious way more revealing than that of autobiographical time. Nider had permission from the Mark Twain estate to combine some 30,000 words from the unpublished dictations with what Payne and DeVoto had already published. Like DeVoto, he omitted what he disliked and was also obliged to exclude portions that Clara Clemens Samosud, Clemens's daughter by then in her 80s, disapproved of publishing. He then, figuratively, cut apart and rearranged the texts he had selected so that they approximated a conventional chronological narrative. Exactly the kind of autobiography Mark Twain had rejected. The result of these several editorial plans has been that no text of the autobiography so far published is even remotely complete, much less completely authorial. It is therefore the goal of the present edition to publish the complete text as nearly as possible in the way Mark Twain intended it to be published after his death. That goal has only recently become attainable, for the simple reason that no one knew which parts of the great mass of autobiographical manuscripts and typescripts Mark Twain intended to include. In fact, the assumption had long prevailed that Mark Twain did not decide what to put in and what to leave out, that he left the enormous and very complicated manuscript incomplete and unfinished. That assumption was wrong. Although Mark Twain left no specific instructions, not even documentation for the instructions that Payne professed to follow, hidden within the approximately 10 file feet of autobiographical documents are more than enough clues to show that he had in fact decided on the final form of the autobiography, and which of the preliminary experiments were to be included and which omitted. This newly discovered and unexpected insight into his intentions is itself a story worth telling, and it is told for the first time in this introduction. 3 printed volumes are planned for this edition, which will also be published in full at Mark Twain Project Online, MTPO. Exhaustive documentation of all textual decisions will only be published online. This first volume begins with the extant manuscripts and dictations that must now be regarded as Clemens's preliminary efforts to write the autobiography, and that he reviewed and rejected, but did not destroy, in June 1906. They are arranged arbitrarily in the order of their date of composition, solely because Clemens himself never specified any order. Some of these texts he explicitly labeled autobiography, and some are judged to be part of his early experiments on other grounds, always explained in the brief headnotes that introduce them. We include those preliminary texts for which the evidence is reasonably strong, without asserting that there were no others. The autobiography of Mark Twain proper begins on page 201 in this volume, starting with the several prefaces Clemens created in June 1906 to frame the early manuscripts and dictations he had selected as opening texts, followed by his almost daily autobiographical dictations, from the 9th of January through the end of March 1906, all that will fit into this volume. The dictations are arranged in the chronological order of their creation, because that is how Clemens instructed his editors to publish them. The remaining volumes in this edition will include all the dictations he created between April 1906 and October 1909, likewise arranged chronologically, the whole concluding with the closing words of my autobiography, a manuscript about the death of his youngest daughter, Jean. Preliminary manuscripts and dictations. Autobiographical fiction and fictional autobiography. Autobiography as a literary form had a special fascination for Mark Twain. Long before he had given serious thought to writing his own, he had published both journalism and fiction that were, in the most straightforward way, autobiographical. From the earliest juvenilia in his brother's Hannibal, Missouri newspaper, 1851-53, to his personal brand of journalism in Nevada and California, 1862-66, he played endlessly with putting himself at the center of what he wrote. 20 years and 9 books later, in October 1886, he acknowledged, and oversimplified, the result. "Yes, the truth is, my books are simply autobiographies. I do not know that there is an incident in them which sets itself forth as having occurred in my personal experience which did not so occur. If the incidents were dated, they could be strung together in their due order, and the result would be an autobiography." He was thinking of his travel books and personal narratives, The Innocents Abroad, Roughing It, A Tramp Abroad, and Life on the Mississippi, the only books up to that point in which he set forth anything as having occurred in his own experience. To be sure, he also made extensive fictional use of that experience. The factual basis of characters and situations in works like The Gilded Age, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, and Adventures of Huckleberry Finn has been thoroughly documented, and the autobiographical content is obvious in dozens of shorter works like The Private History of a Campaign That Failed, and My First Lie and How I Got Out of It, even when they are not entirely factual. More germane to Clemens's thinking about his own autobiography is his interest in fictional autobiography, that is, fictions in the shape and form of an autobiography. Mark Twain's burlesque autobiography was written in late 1870 and published in pamphlet form in March 1871. Mark Twain tells us that his own parents were neither very poor nor conspicuously honest, and that almost all of his ancestors were born to be hanged, and for the most part were hanged. An even briefer burlesque, called simply An Autobiography, appeared in the Aldine magazine in April 1871. "I was born November 30th, 1835. I continued to live just the same." The whole sketch takes fewer than 200 words and pointedly leaves the reader as ignorant of the facts as before. Burlesque implies familiarity with genuine autobiographies, despite what Clemens told William Dean Howells in 1877. "I didn't know there were any but old Franklin's and Benvenuto Cellini's." Benjamin Franklin's didactic bent made him a lifelong target of Mark Twain's ridicule, but he thought Cellini's autobiography the most entertaining of books, and he admired the daring frankness of Jean-Jacques Rousseau's Confessions and Giovanni Giacomo Casanova's Mémoire, as well as Samuel Pepys's Diary, which Paine said was the book Clemens read and quoted most. In 1871, he proposed writing An Autobiography of Old Parr, the gentleman who lived to be 153 years old, but apparently he never did so. In the summer of 1876, he wrote 400 pages of a work he was then calling Huck Finn's autobiography. And in March 1877, he told Howells he was writing such a work about his own older brother. "I began Orion's autobiography yesterday and am charmed with the work. I have started him at 18, Printer's apprentice, soft and sappy, full of fine intentions and shifting religions, and not aware that he is a shining ass." He assigned various real incidents of Orion's life and aspects of his character to an apprentice named Bolivar, and wrote more than 100 pages before abandoning the project. In 1880, Orion's decision to write a real autobiography prompted Clemens to suggest that he instead write two books, which it has long been my purpose to write, but I judge they are so far down on my docket that I shan't get to them in this life. I think the subjects are perfectly new. One is The Autobiography of a Coward, and the other, Confessions of a Life That Was a Failure. The object here was not burlesque, but rather a kind of thought experiment to test the difficulty of telling the whole truth in an autobiographical narrative, in this case by shielding it behind a deliberate fiction. My plan was simple, to take the absolute facts of my own life and tell them simply and without ornament or flourish, exactly as they occurred, with this difference, that I would turn every courageous action, if I ever performed one, into a cowardly one, and every success into a failure. You can do this, but only in one way. You must banish all idea of an audience. For no man, crossed out, few men can straightly and squarely confess shameful things to others. You must tell your story to yourself and to no other. You must not use your own name, for that would keep you from telling shameful things too. Another version of this scheme, Clemens said, was more difficult. To tell the story of an abject coward who is unconscious that he is a coward, and to do the same for an unsuccessful man. In these cases, the titles I have suggested would not be used. This latter plan is the one I should use. I should confine myself to my own actual experiences. To invent would be to fail. And I would name everybody's actual name and locality and describe his character and actions unsparingly, then change these names and localities after the book was finished. To use fictitious names and localities while writing is a befogging and confusing thing. The inspiration for both of these ideas was obviously two autobiographies that Clemens admired. The supremest charm in Casanova's memoir, they are not printed in English, is that he frankly, flowingly, and felicitously tells the dirtiest and vilest and most contemptible things on himself, without ever suspecting that they are other than things which the reader will admire and applaud. Rousseau confesses to masturbation, theft, lying, shameful treachery, and attempts made upon his person by sodomites. But he tells it as a man who is perfectly aware of the shameful nature of these things, whereas your coward and your failure should be happy and sweet and unconscious of their own contemptibility, crossed out. Clemens himself seems not to have attempted what he urged Orion to try, but it is obvious he was thinking about the challenge of writing with the perfect frankness he admired in these writers. The question of how fully he could tell the truth about himself, and especially to what extent he could confess what he regarded as his own shameful behavior, occupied him off and on throughout work on the autobiography. The first attempts, 1876 and 1877. Clemens's plan to write his own autobiography is more or less distinct from these fictional uses of the form. The first indication that he had such a plan survives only in the report of a conversation that took place when he was 40. Mrs. James T. Fields and her husband were visiting the Clemenses in Hartford. She recorded in her diary that at lunch, on the 28th of April, 1876, Clemens proceeded to speak of his autobiography, which he intends to write as fully and sincerely as possible to leave behind him. His wife laughingly said she should look it over and leave out objectionable passages. "No," he said very earnestly, almost sternly, "you are not to edit it. It is to appear as it is written, with the whole tale told as truly as I can tell it. I shall take out passages from it and publish as I go along, in the Atlantic and elsewhere, but I shall not limit myself as to space, and at whatever age I am writing about, even if I am an infant, and an idea comes to me about myself when I am 40, I shall put that in. Every man feels that his experience is unlike that of anybody else, and therefore he should write it down. He finds also that everybody else has thought and felt on some points precisely as he has done, and therefore he should write it down. This remarkable statement shows that Clemens was already committed to several ideas that would govern the autobiography he worked on over the next 35 years. The notion is already present that publication must be posthumous, a requirement linked to the ambition to have the whole tale told as truly as I can tell it, without censoring himself or allowing others to do it for him. He also plans to publish selections from the narrative while still alive, withholding the rest to leave behind him. He will not limit himself as to space, but will be as digressive and discursive as he likes, even ignoring chronology when it suits him. These cardinal points are clearly interrelated. Absolute truth-telling would be made easier by knowing that his own death would precede publication, and discursiveness, quite apart from his natural preference for it, would help to disarm his own impulse toward self-censorship. But it would take another 30 years to actually apply these various ideas to a real autobiography. Just a year or so later, sometime in 1877, Clemens seems actually to have begun writing, prompted, as he recalled in 1904, by a conversation with his good friend John Milton Hay. Hay asked if I had begun to write my autobiography, and I said I hadn't. He said that I ought to begin at once, since the time to begin was at age 40, and Clemens was already 42. I had lost 2 years, but I resolved to make up that loss. I resolved to begin my autobiography at once. I did begin it, but the resolve melted away and disappeared in a week, and I threw my beginning away. Since then, about every 3 or 4 years, I have made other beginnings and thrown them away. Once I tried the experiment of a diary, intending to inflate that into an autobiography when its accumulation should furnish enough material. But that experiment lasted only a week. It took me half of every night to set down the history of the day, and at the week's end, I did not like the result. In late November 1877, Clemens listed my autobiography among other projects in his notebook, reminding himself to publish scraps from my autobiography occasionally. He did indeed write an 11-page manuscript at this time, which he intended as the first chapter of an autobiography, very likely the beginning that in 1904 he remembered having thrown away. He titled it merely Chapter 1, but it is commonly known as Early Years in Florida, Missouri, the title Paine assigned it. It begins, "I was born the 30th of November, 1835, the same way Clemens began his Aldine Burlesque in 1871, and it goes on to reminisce briefly about his early memories of childhood in that almost invisible village of Florida, Monroe County, Missouri. Like the Tennessee Land, the only extant autobiographical fragment that was written earlier in 1870, it ends somewhat abruptly, exactly as if the author's interest had melted away and disappeared. If Clemens did, as he says, make successive attempts to write the autobiography every 3 or 4 years after 1877, few are known to survive. What we have instead are such things as his advice in 1880 to Orion about his autobiography. Keep in mind what I told you. When you recollect something which belonged in an earlier chapter, do not go back, but jam it in where you are. Discursiveness does not hurt an autobiography in the least." Clemens took between 3 and 7 years to complete almost all of his major books. He required that much time chiefly because he always encountered stretches during which he was unable to proceed, and composition came to a complete halt. Since at least 1871, he had found it necessary, when his tank had run dry in this way, to pigeonhole his manuscripts. And he learned to resume work on them only after the tank had been refilled by unconscious and profitable cerebration. But the time he spent on his earlier books is brief compared with the nearly 4 decades it took him to finish his autobiography. Its construction was certainly punctuated by long interruptions as well, but for somewhat different reasons. Until January 1906, the tank seemed to run dry after relatively brief stints of writing or dictating, because he grew dissatisfied with his method of composing the work, or with its overall plan, or both. General Grant and James W. Page, 1885 and 1890. In the spring of 1885, Clemens made his first attempt at doing an autobiography for which more than a few pages survive. He had some previous experience with dictating letters and brief memoranda to a secretary, but he had never tried it for literary composition. Now he decided that it might be a good way to work on the autobiography. In late March, he wrote in his notebook, "Get Shorthander in New York and begin my autobiography at once and continue it straight through the summer." Which reminds me that Susie, age 13, 1885, has begun to write my biography, solely of her own motion, a thing about which I feel proud and gratified. At breakfast this morning, I intimated that if I seemed to be talking on a pretty high key in the way of style, it must be remembered that my biographer was present. Whereupon Susie struck upon the unique idea of having me sit up and purposely talk for the biography. At about the same time, he realized that dictation might be of help to his friend Ulysses S. Grant. Grant had written several articles for the Century magazine's series on the Civil War. In the spring of 1885, when he was dying of throat cancer, Grant was close to completing the manuscript of the first volume of his two-volume memoirs. Clemens had recently secured them for his own publishing house, Charles L. Webster and Company, confident they would earn large profits both for Grant's family and for himself. As a frequent visitor to Grant's New York house, Clemens knew that Grant feared dying before he could finish his book. He suggested that Grant hire a stenographer to ease his task. Grant at first demurred, but later hired a former secretary, Noble E. Dawson. On the 29th of April, Clemens visited Grant on his first day of dictation and learned that it was a thorough success. No doubt encouraged by Grant's experience, in early May, Clemens asked his friend and former lecture manager, James Redpath, to serve as his stenographer. He liked and respected Redpath, who had been a journalist and knew shorthand. On the 4th of May, 1885, Redpath replied to Clemens's proposal. "Now, about the auto. When I do work by the week, I charge $100 a week for the best I can do. I've had a run of ill luck lately, but I found that that was what I averaged. It would take you much less time than you think. I get you word for word, and it takes a long time to write out." Clemens accepted these terms and urged Redpath to come to Hartford soon. "I think we can make this thing blamed enjoyable." It is clear that he was beginning to intuit the need for a responsive human audience when dictating, something he articulated quite clearly 6 years later in a letter to Howells. The two men began working together sometime in mid-May and continued for several weeks. In the six dictations that survive, Clemens traced the history of his friendship with Grant, then talked about his own protege, the young sculptor Carl Gerhardt, who had a commission to create a bust of Grant. In the longest of these dictations, he launched into a detailed account of how he had acquired the right to publish Grant's memoirs, defending his tactics and countering newspaper insinuations that he had acted unethically. Clemens probably stopped dictating shortly before Grant died on the 23rd of July, 1885. In July and August, and possibly earlier, Clemens read over some of the typescripts that Redpath had created from his stenographic notes, adding his own corrections here and there, but making few changes in wording. He found the result far from satisfactory, as he implied in a letter to Henry Ward Beecher. "I will enclose some scraps from my autobiography, scraps about General Grant. They may be of some trifle of use, and they may not. They at least verify known traits of his character. My autobiography is pretty freely dictated, but my idea is to jackplane it a little before I die some day or other. I mean the rude construction and rotten grammar. It is the only dictating I ever did, and it was most troublesome and awkward work." Redpath's work as an amanuensis was unskillful. None of his stenographic notes are known to survive, but his typescripts are manifestly ill-prepared, full of typing errors, struck-over characters and extraneous marks, and his numerous penciled corrections create punctuation that is in no way characteristic of Clemens's own habits. No manuscripts for the autobiography written between 1885 and 1890 have survived, but the project was certainly not forgotten. In late 1886, as he worked on The Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, Clemens wrote to Mary Mason Fairbanks, "I fully expect to write one other book besides this one, two others, in fact, if one's autobiography may be called a book. In fact, mine will be nearer a library." His 1876 plan for a work not limited as to space was evidently alive and well. And in August 1887, 2 years after halting the Grant dictations, Clemens wrote to his nephew, "I want a perfect copy of Fred Grant's letter for my autobiography. I was supposing I had about finished the detailed private history of the Grant memoirs, but doubtless more than one offensive chapter must be added yet if Fred Grant lives. A few months earlier, he told another correspondent, "No, I'll leave those details in my autobiography when I die, but they won't answer for a speech." Then in December 1887, Orion wrote to ask his brother's permission to reveal something of your boyhood in an upcoming interview with a local journalist. He listed a few points he wanted to offer. "I thought of mentioning Grandpa and Grandma Casey, some younger and older characteristics of Ma, fondness for or tenderness for animals, etc. Pa's studying law under Cyrus Walker, their marriage and removal to Tennessee, Pa's treatment of the strange preacher about the cow, his facing down the old bully, Frog, his settling a dispute before him as justice of the peace with a mallet, your philosophical dissatisfaction with your lack of a tail, your sleepwalking and entrance into Mrs. Ammon's room, your year's schooling, your quitting at 11, your work in my office, your first writing for the paper, Jim Wolfe, the washpan and the broom, your going to Philadelphia at 17, your swimming the river and back, Ma's complaint that you broke up her scoldings by making her laugh, Pa's death, his sharp pen writing for the paper, her present age and vigor, fondness for theater." Clemens had already used a number of these points in published work. His making wicked fun of Jim Wolfe's pointless rescue of a washpan and broom from the threat of a fire next door was, in fact, his first writing for Orion's Hannibal newspaper, A Gallant Fireman, 1851. And in the first chapter of Tom Sawyer, Aunt Polly, based on Jane Clemens, had mildly complained that Tom knew that if he could make me laugh, her anger toward him would disappear. Still, Clemens refused Orion's request. "I have never yet allowed an interviewer or biography sketcher to get out of me any circumstance of my history which I thought might be worth putting someday into my autobiography. I have been approached as many as 500 times on the biographical sketch lay, but they never got anything that was worth printing." Clemens would make use of only a few of these points in the autobiography. But his stinginess about letting others reveal the raw materials of his history is certainly understandable, and it may suggest that at this time in 1887 he still intended to write an autobiography that would include these anecdotes from his early life. By the fall of 1890, Clemens had been investing money in the typesetting machine invented by James W. Page for almost 10 years, since 1881. It was, however, still not completed. The relevance of this project to his autobiography was inescapable, and in the closing days of that year he began to write The Machine Episode, an unsparing account of the way Page had charmed and beguiled him into an enormous investment without having yet achieved a saleable product. By the time Clemens added the second part to this self-revealing account, in the winter of 1893-94, Page had still not perfected the machine, but was about to sign a new, more satisfactory contract for it. Left in a rather unfinished state, the manuscript was very likely among those Clemens reviewed in 1906, before deciding to omit it from the final form. He did return to the subject in an autobiographical dictation of 2 June 1906. Vienna, 1897 and 1898. Clemens's hopes for the Page typesetting machine were finally crushed in December 1894, and the bankruptcy of Webster & Company earlier that year had placed its debts solely on his shoulders. In the summer of 1895, in order to repay them, he, Olivia, and Clara undertook a lecture tour around the world, Susie and Jean stayed at home, which ended when they arrived in England on the 31st of July, 1896. The family landed at Southampton and then traveled to Guildford, where they learned that Susie was ill in Hartford. A fortnight later, Mrs. Clemens and Clara sailed for home to nurse Susie, Clemens recalled in 1906, and found her in her coffin in her grandmother's house. Within weeks of this calamity, Clemens wrote his friend Henry H. Rogers that he intended to submerge myself and my troubles in work. In the last week of September 1896, he reminded himself to write my autobiography in full and with remorseless attention to facts and proper names. But he still needed to finish the book about his around-the-world lecture tour. The family spent the winter and spring of 1897 in London while Clemens wrote Following the Equator, which would be published in November. In the summer of 1897, they retreated to Switzerland, and in late September they moved to Vienna. Two autobiographical manuscripts were begun that fall, Travel Scraps 1 and a much longer sketch called My Autobiography, Random Extracts from It. Travel Scraps 1 appears to be unfinished, or at least not quite ready for the typist, since Clemens made a tentative revision of its title in pencil. Travel crossed out Scraps from Autobiog, and the manuscript itself still has two sets of page numbers, 1 through 20 and 1 through 28. It was probably written soon after Clemens arrived in Vienna, for it is largely a complaint about London's cab drivers and its postal service, things that would naturally have been on his mind since the spring. On the evidence of the paper and ink used, My Autobiography, Random Extracts from It, was begun about the same time, but probably not completed until 1898. Clemens identified the text as From Chapter 2. The first page of this manuscript is reproduced in facsimile at www.marktwainproject.org and at www.blackstoneaudio.com on the product description page. It begins as a history of the Clemens and Lambton relatives and ancestors, and more briefly, the despised Tennessee land. But it meanders, without apology, into an anecdote about an incident in Berlin in 1891, and it ends with an evocative description of Clemens's idyllic summers on his uncle's farm near Florida, Missouri. This typical combination of early memories and later experiences helps to make clear why Clemens would reject the idea of a completely chronological narrative. His preference for juxtaposing related events from different times deeply resisted that way of organizing his story. At the same time, labeling the sketch From Chapter 2 implied that most of what it contained would come early in the autobiography, as would befit a review of ancestors. The chapter number suggests that while he was not writing about his experiences in the order of their occurrence, he was still making an attempt to assign chapter numbers that respected chronology. Before Clemens completed Random Extracts in 1898, he wrote several more sketches for the autobiography between February and June of that year, grouped here under the supplied title, Four Sketches About Vienna, Beauties of the German Language, Comment on Tautology and Grammar, A Group of Servants, the only one that Paine did not include in his edition, and A Viennese Procession. These were not reminiscences, but rather more like entries in a diary, with each piece prefaced by a date. None of these sketches would be included in his final plan, but he did eventually include another manuscript written at this time, Dueling, in the autobiographical dictation of the 19th of January, 1906. Two further sketches were written in the fall of 1898 and also later inserted into the final structure of autobiographical dictations. The first was Wapping Alice, a tale deemed unsuitable for magazine publication, which was based on an actual event. It joined a growing collection of manuscripts that Clemens would eventually draw on for what he called FAT, Old Pigeonholed Things of the Years Gone By Which I or Editors Didn't Dast to Print, that he would use to enlarge the bulk of the autobiography. More than a year after he began dictating his autobiography in 1906, he inserted Wapping Alice in the autobiographical dictation of the 9th of April, 1907. The second sketch was My Debut as a Literary Person, which he dated October 1, 1898, and labeled Chapter 14. The revision of this manuscript reflects a season of discouragement about the autobiography, a mood that shows up sporadically during the winter of 1898-99. Just below the title, he first inserted a footnote, "This is Chapter 14 of my unfinished autobiography, and the way it is getting along, it promises to remain an unfinished one." Then he changed unfinished to unpublished and canceled the words following autobiography. When the sketch appeared in the Century magazine for November 1899, it omitted any reference to his autobiography. Still, it is the first chapter to be published in fulfillment of his long-held plan to publish selections from it. Clemens's unsettled attitude toward his unfinished autobiography is clear, but not readily explained. On the 10th of October, 1898, even as he was preparing My Debut for magazine publication, he told Edward Bach, editor of the Ladies' Home Journal, "A good deal of the autobiography is written, but I never work on it except when a reminiscence of some kind crops up in a strong way and in a manner forces me. So it is years too early yet to think of publishing, except now and then at long intervals, a single chapter maybe. I intend to do that someday. but it would not answer for your magazine. Indeed, a good deal of it is written in too independent a fashion for a magazine. One may publish a book and print whatever his family shall approve and allow to pass, but it is the public that edit a magazine, and so by the sheer necessities of the case, a magazine's liberties are rather limited. For instance, a few days ago I wrote Chapter 14. My debut as a literary person. My wife edited it, approved it, with enthusiasm, this is unusual, and said, "Send it to you and retire the platonic sweetheart." It was a good idea, and I said I would. But on my way to the village post office with it, I remembered that it contained a sentence of 9 words which you would have to drive a blue pencil through, so that blocked that scheme. A month later, in a more ambitious frame of mind, he wrote to Rogers that he now planned to take up my uncompleted autobiography and finish it and let Bliss and Chatto each make $15,000 out of it for me next fall, as they did with the Equator book. But almost immediately he changed his mind about the need for money and concluded that he would never write the autobiography till I'm in a hole. It is best for me to be in a hole sometimes, I reckon. Then, just a few days later, he wrote again to Rogers. "I have resumed my autobiography, and I suppose I shall have Volume 1 done by springtime." "I hope so," crossed out. "I expect so." And at last, in February 1899, still trying to find a magazine publisher for my debut, he told Century editor Richard Watson Gilder, "I have abandoned my autobiography and am not going to finish it, but I took a reminiscent chapter out of it some time ago and had it copyrighted," crossed out, "and had it typewritten, thinking it would make a readable magazine article." So within the span of a few months, he claimed that a good deal of the autobiography was written, that he would never finish it until he was in a hole, that he expected to have the first volume done by springtime, and that he had abandoned it altogether. He was obviously struggling with how, or even whether, to proceed with a work that had been in and out of the pigeonhole for 20 years. Innumerable biographies, 1898 and 1899. It is difficult to be entirely sure, but Clemens seems to have become discouraged, at least in part, over his inability to be completely frank and self-revealing, after the fashion of Rousseau and Casanova. His solution was, at least temporarily, to recast the autobiography as a series of thumbnail biographies of people he had met over the years. Several autobiographical manuscripts written in Vienna, Horace Greeley, Lecture Times, and Ralph Keeler, are character sketches that were part of this reconception, one that he also relied on to some extent in 1904. The Vienna portraits recall men and women whom he knew in his days on the Lyceum circuit in the early 1870s. The new plan probably owed something to the idea of a lecture he wrote back then called "Reminiscences of Some Uncommonplace Characters I Have Chanced to Meet." He delivered this lecture, which he said covered his whole acquaintance, kings, humorists, lunatics, idiots, and all, only twice. No text of it is known to survive, but in Vienna he evidently resurrected its premise. In an interview for the London Times in May 1899, the reporter explained, "Mr. Clemens has kindly given me permission to telegraph to the Times some particulars of a pet scheme of his, to which he has already devoted a great deal of his time, and which will occupy a great part of the remainder of his life. In some respects it will be unparalleled in the history of literature. It is a bequest to posterity in which none of those now living and comparatively few of their grandchildren even will have any part or share. This is a work which is only to be published 100 years after his death as a portrait gallery of contemporaries with whom he has come into personal contact. These are drawn solely for his own pleasure in the work, and with the single object of telling the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, without malice, and to serve no grudge, but at the same time without respect of persons or social conventions, institutions, or pruderies of any kind." Clemens even spelled out exactly why he had abandoned his original plan for an autobiography. "You cannot lay bare your private soul and look at it. You are too much ashamed of yourself. It is too disgusting. For that reason, I confine myself to drawing the portraits of others." And in an interview after he returned to London, he said again that the new idea had actually supplanted his earlier ideas for the autobiography. "I'm not going to write autobiography. The man has yet to be born who could write the truth about himself. Autobiography is always interesting, but howsoever true its facts may be, its interpretation of them must be taken with a great deal of allowance." In the innumerable biographies I am writing, many persons are represented who are not famous today, but who may be someday. If this switch to biographical portraits signaled frustration over the puzzle of how to tell even the shameful truths, his interest in it was still relatively brief. We have no indication that he wrote any further portraits until 1904, and by 1906 the character sketch idea had fallen entirely out of favor. For about a year, Clemens seems not to have added anything to his accumulation of autobiographical chapters. In the fall of 1899, he moved his family to London and for about a year seems to have taken leave of the autobiography. Scraps and Chapters, 1900-1903. Clemens's use of the terms scraps and extracts, as well as random, in 1897-98 suggests that he was looking for a way to label chapters, which, while not themselves strictly chronological, might still have been parts of some coherent narrative sequence. In the fall of 1900, he used the term scraps in the titles of three more sketches for the autobiography: Travel Scraps 2, Scraps from My Autobiography, Private History of a Manuscript That Came to Grief, and Scraps from My Autobiography, from Chapter 9. Only one of these made it into the final form. Travel Scraps 2 continued the 1897 recital of grievances about London's telephones and postal system, and was ultimately inserted in the autobiographical dictation for the 27th of February, 1907. Scraps from My Autobiography, Private History of a Manuscript That Came to Grief, was much longer. It concerned a recent experience with T. Douglas Murray, an amateur historian, who had invited Clemens to write an introduction for an English translation of Joan of Arc's trial records. Clemens submitted his draft and wrote Murray, "When I send the introduction, I must get you to do two things for me. Knock the lies out of it and purify the grammar, which I think stinks in one place." Murray took this invitation all too literally and proceeded to revise the text extensively, making the language more formal, even pretentious. Enraged by this tampering, Clemens proceeded to draft a reply in the shape of a scathing letter to Murray, which, of course, he never sent, preparing it instead for the autobiography. The third manuscript, also excluded from the final form, nevertheless illustrates a rather different dynamic, namely the persistent reluctance or inability to break entirely free from the chronological structure of conventional autobiography. The manuscript was titled, as revised, Selections, crossed out, Scraps from My Autobiography, Passages, F, crossed out, from Chapter 9. Payne thought it was written about 1898, but it was in fact written in 1900, as one reference in the text makes clear. The assignment of a chapter number is something that it shares with only a handful of other manuscripts, summarized in the following list. Chapter 1, written in 1877, describes Clemens's home until aged 4 when the family moved to Hannibal. Chapter 2, written in 1897-98, My Autobiography, Random Extracts from It, Clemens aged 7 to 12. Chapter 4, written in 1903, Scraps from My Autobiography, from Chapter 4, transcribed in autobiographical dictations, 1st and 2nd of December 1906, Clemens aged 14. Chapter 9, written in 1900, Scraps from My Autobiography, from Chapter 9, Clemens, aged 14, 38, and 61. Chapter 12, not found, but written after 1898 since it refers to Vienna. Clemens, aged 62, mentioned in Chapter 17. Chapter 14, written in 1898, My Debut as a Literary Person. Clemens, aged 30. Chapter 17, written in 1903, from Chapter 17, transcribed in autobiographical dictation, 3rd of December 1906, Clemens, aged 62. Although some additional numbered chapters may have been written and subsequently lost or destroyed, it is highly unlikely that in 1903, when Clemens labeled the text Chapter 17, he had actually written 17 chapters. But the numbers assigned to the chapters that do survive correspond roughly to the chronology of their topics, even though they do not accurately reflect the lapse of time. Clemens was 14 in both Chapter 4 and Chapter 9, but between Chapter 9 and Chapter 14, he aged from 14 to 30, and then to age 62 by chapter 17. Still, this rough approximation is exactly what one would expect if the chapter numbers were only estimates intended to place the chapters in approximate chronological order. Together, they again suggest that although he was not writing about his life in the order of its occurrences, he was still trying to maintain an overall chronology, even as late as 1903. The text numbered Chapter 9, Scraps from My Autobiography, written in 1900, is suggestive in a related way. The chapter number would place it relatively early in his life. It recounts two stories from Clemens's youth, when he was 14, 1849 to 50, but it concludes each story with much later events, the first in Calcutta in 1896 when he was 61, and the second in London in 1873 when he was 38. In both cases, it seems that to follow the stories to what Clemens regarded as their natural conclusion, it was necessary to skip over several decades of his life. So, whatever else Chapter 9 was in 1900, it was not a purely chronological account, even though the chapter number placed it toward the beginning of the narrative. A similar tension occurs in the two manuscripts with chapter numbers written in 1903 but revised in 1906 after Clemens had settled on discursiveness as the principle for the whole autobiography. Both were inserted into the dictations for the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of December 1906. In 1903, he titled the first one Scraps from My Autobiography, from Chapter 4, and began it with a marginal date, 1849 to 51. It concerns his youthful encounters with mesmerism in Hannibal. The second 1903 manuscript, paginated separately but probably written at the same time, they share the same ink and paper, brought this story to its conclusion. It is another story about mesmerism in which a haughty aristocrat is embarrassed by being hypnotized and ordered to undress, in retaliation for his incredulity. Clemens originally titled it From Chapter 17, but when he decided to use the manuscripts in the December dictations, he removed all reference to chapter numbers. So, the first mesmerism story was originally assigned to Chapter 4, and its natural conclusion to Chapter 17, separated by some 12 putative chapters. Their revision shows that in 1903, Clemens was still wrestling with the compulsion to maintain some semblance of his life's chronology, while in 1906, when he made the manuscripts into one continuous narrative, he had clearly shed that compulsion. On the 15th of October 1900, the family arrived in New York City, where they soon rented a house at 14 West 10th Street. "Jean is learning to typewrite," Clemens wrote a friend, "and presently I'll dictate and thereby save some scraps of time." Jean's new skill may have prompted Clemens to think again of dictating rather than writing the autobiography. There were other temptations as well. The president of Harper & Brothers, George Harvey, was clearly interested in the prestige that would flow from having the rights to publish the autobiography, even though it would not actually appear until long after both men had died. On the 17th of October 1900, Harvey proposed to Rogers, who was acting as Clemens's agent, to publish the memoirs in the year 2000, and suggested that Clemens insert a clause in his will to the effect that the memoirs shall be sealed without reading by his executors and deposited with the trust company. The agreement would, of course, provide for publication in whatever modes should then be prevalent, that is, by printing as at present, or by use of phonographic cylinders, or by electrical method, or by any other mode which may then be in use, any number of which would doubtless occur to his vivid imagination and would form an interesting clause in the agreement. Harvey was in fact eager to make Harper & Brothers into Clemens's exclusive American publisher, and on the 14th of November, after much discussion, he proposed a rate of 20 cents a word for the exclusive serial rights to anything he might write in the next year, as well as the exclusive right to publish all of his books in the same period. One week later, Clemens wrote to Harvey, "Let us add the 100-year book to the arrangements again and make it definite, for I am going to dictate that book to my daughter with the certainty that as I go along I shall grind out chapters which will be good for magazine and book today and not need to wait a century." Nothing dictated to Jean at this time has been found, but Clemens soon agreed to Harvey's proposal regarding the publication of my memoirs 100 years hence, although No formal contract for the autobiography was signed at this time. In August 1902, Olivia's health grew alarmingly worse. Despite temporary improvements, it continued to decline, and in 1903, on the recommendation of her doctors, Clemens decided to take the family to Italy. In early November, they settled into the Villa di Quarto near Florence. In addition to Clemens himself, the travelers included Olivia, Clara, and Jean. Three employees were also with them: longtime family servant Katie Leary, a nurse for Olivia, and Isabel V. Lyon, who had been hired in 1902 as Olivia's secretary, but had since assumed more general duties. The Florentine Dictations, 1904. During his 8-month stay in Florence, Clemens made unusual progress on the autobiography, in large part because of a renewed enthusiasm for dictation as a method of composition. He had experimented with mechanical methods of transferring words to paper ever since the dictations to Redpath in 1885. In 1888, he tried, and failed, to get access to one of Thomas Edison's recording phonographs. Then, in 1891, he suffered an attack of rheumatism in his right arm and, compelled by the necessity of working on his current book, The American Claimant, he did briefly experiment with the phonograph. "I feel sure I can dictate the book into a phonograph if I don't have to yell. I write 2,000 words a day. I think I can dictate twice as many," he wrote to Howells on the 28th of February, but by the 4th of April he had concluded that the machine is good enough for mere letter writing, but you can't write literature with it because it hasn't any ideas, and it hasn't any gift for elaboration, or smartness of talk, or vigor of action, or felicity of expression, but is just matter-of-fact, compressive, unornamental, and as grave and unsmiling as the devil. I filled 4 dozen cylinders in 2 sittings, then found I could have said about as much with the pen and said it a deal better. Then I resigned. I believe it could teach one to dictate literature to a phonographer, and sometime I will experiment in that line. His expectation in December 1900 of relying on Jean to type up dictated autobiography at last became a reality in January 1904, when he tried dictating once more, but not to a machine, according to Isabel Lyon. "About January 14th, Mr. Clemens began to dictate to me. His idea of writing an autobiography had never proved successful, for to his mind autobiography is like narrative and should be spoken. At Mrs. Clemens's suggestion we tried, and Mr. Clemens found that he could do it to a charm. In fact, he loves the work. But we have had to stop, for he has been ill, Mrs. Clemens has been very ill, and I, too, have taken a weary turn in bed." Lyon did not know shorthand, and so took down Clemens's words in full, then gave Jean her record to be typed. Shortly after he had begun to dictate, Clemens wrote to Howells on the 16th of January, "I've struck it, and I will give it away to you. You will never know how much enjoyment you have lost until you get to dictating your autobiography. Then you will realize with a pang that you might have been doing it all your life if you had only had the luck to think of it. And you will be astonished and charmed to see how like talk it is, and how real it sounds, and how well and compactly and sequentially it constructs itself, and what a dewy and breezy and woodsy freshness it has, and what a darling and worshipful absence of the signs of starch and flat iron and labor and fuss and the other artificialities. Mrs. Clemens is an exacting critic, but I have not talked a sentence yet that she has wanted altered. There are little slips here and there, little inexactnesses, and many desertions of a thought before the end of it has been reached, but these are not blemishes, they are merits. Their removal would take away the naturalness of the flow and banish the very thing, the nameless something, which differentiates real narrative from artificial narrative, and makes the one so vastly better than the other. The subtle something which makes good talk so much better than the best imitation of it that can be done with a pen." It seems that he recognized Lyon's lack of shorthand as an advantage, for he went on to urge Howells to try this method, but with a longhand scribe, not with a stenographer, at least not at first, not until you get your hand in, I should say. "There's a good deal of waiting, of course, but that is no matter. Soon you do not mind it." More important even than the leisurely pace was the scribe's role as audience. Miss Lyons does the scribing and is an inspiration because she takes so much interest in it. I dictate from 10:30 till noon. The result is about 1,500 words. Then I am a free man and can read and smoke the rest of the day, for there's not a correction to be made. Dictation proved so congenial, in fact, that his opinion of the drafts and experiments he had written over the years now began to change. He continued to Howells, "I've a good many chapters of Auto, written with a pen from time to time and laid away in envelopes, but I expect that when I come to examine them, I shall throw them away and do them over again with my mouth, for I feel sure that my quondam satisfaction in them will have vanished, and that they will seem poor and artificial and lacking in color." One would expect dictated stuff to read like an impromptu speech, brokenly, catchily, repetitiously, and marred by absence of coherence, fluent movement, and the happy things that didn't come till the speech was done. But it isn't so. Howells replied to this letter on the 14th of February, shrewdly raising a familiar issue, clearly not for the first time, the difficulty of telling the whole truth. "I'd like immensely to read your autobiography. You always rather bewildered me by your veracity, and I fancy you may tell the truth about yourself. But all of it? The black truth, which we all know of ourselves in our hearts, or only the whitey-brown truth of the pericardium, or the nice whitened truth of the shirt front? Even you won't tell the black heart's truth. The man who could do it would be famed to the last day the sun shone upon." Clemens had, of course, already reached the same skeptical conclusion. He answered Howells, "Yes, I set up the safeguards in the first day's dictating, taking this position, that an autobiography is the truest of all books, for while it inevitably consists mainly of extinctions of the truth, shirkings of the truth, partial revealments of the truth, with hardly an instance of plain straight truth, the remorseless truth is there, between the lines, where the author cat is raking dust upon it, which hides from the disinterested spectator neither it nor its smell, though I didn't use that figure. The result being that the reader knows the author in spite of his wily diligences." What those safeguards were remains unknown, since no copy of the first day's dictating has survived. The most one can say is that Clemens seems to have moved on from his despair at not being able to tell the black heart's truth, rationalizing that that truth would emerge anyway, in spite of all his attempts to suppress it. In a dictation made in late January 1904, he hinted at the disinhibiting nature of talk. "Within the last 8 or 10 years, I have made several attempts to do the autobiography in one way or another with a pen, but the result was not satisfactory. It was too literary. With a pen in the hand, the narrative stream is a canal. It moves slowly, smoothly, decorously, sleepily. It has no blemish except that it is all blemish. It is too literary, too prim, too nice. The gait and style and movement are not suited to narrative." 2 years later, in mid-June 1906, he would look back on this time in 1904 as the moment he discovered freewheeling spoken narrative as the right way to do an autobiography. Only 6 Florentine dictations are known to survive. 3 of them are portraits of friends or acquaintances: John Hay, Robert Louis Stevenson and Thomas Bailey Aldrich, and Henry H. Rogers, presumably products of the portrait gallery concept. 2 are reminiscences, notes on Innocence Abroad, and a sketch, untitled, recalling his first use of the typewriter. The 6th is a complaint about the Villa di Quarto, the family's current residence near Florence. It is the longest and least polished, an extended diatribe about the rented villa, and especially its hated owner, the Countess Massilia. Clemens concluded it by inserting an 1892 manuscript about the Villa Viviani, where the Clemenses had lived during an earlier, more enjoyable stay in Florence. Despite that moderating addition, the 1904 dictation is replete with fiery insults to the Countess. So much so that when, in May and June 1906, Clemens considered publishing selections of autobiography with S.S. McClure, he marked in blue pencil the offending passages on Jean's typescript and wrote, on the verso of page 2, "Leave out that blue-penciled passage and all blue-penciled passages in the first edition," and added, "Restore them in later editions. It is clear that there were Florentine dictations that have not survived, at least not as originally dictated. In August 1906, Clemens said that he had created more than a dozen little biographies, of which we have almost none. By my count, estimating from the time when I began these dictations 2 years ago in Italy, I have been in the right mood for competently and exhaustively feeding fat my ancient grudges in the cases of only 13 deserving persons. One woman and 12 men. It makes good reading. Whenever I go back and reread those little biographies and characterizations, it cheers me up, and I feel that I have not lived in vain. The work was well done. The art of it is masterly. I admire it more and more every time I examine it. I do believe I have flayed and mangled and mutilated those people beyond the dreams of avarice. Only one such Florentine dictation is known to survive. Clemens certainly flayed the Countess Massilia in Villa di Quarto. We can only guess who the deserving men were by considering other evidence. For example, in a letter of the 29th of January, 1904, Clemens vented his anger toward Henry A. Butters, head of the American Plasmon Company, whom he held responsible for his investment losses. As soon as I get back, we will pull Butters into court, and I guess we can jail him. He occupies space enough in my autobiography to pay back all he and his pimp have robbed me of. That last sentence crossed out. But no such text from 1904 or earlier survives, and Butters is mentioned only in passing in the later autobiographical dictations. On the 31st of October 1908, for example, Clemens described him as easily the meanest white man and the most degraded in spirit and contemptible in character I have ever known. There are others who might have received harsh treatment in now lost dictations from 1904, whose portraits were then done over between January and August 1906. Clemens scattered a few sarcastic remarks about Charles L. Webster in the early 1906 dictations, then excoriated him at length in the one for the 29th of May 1906. Other candidates include Daniel Whitford, Clemens's attorney, James W. Page, inventor of the failed typesetter, and, of course, Bret Harte.